Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome and happy holidays. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizban, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Hey. All right, so the quote of the week is by Friedrich Nietzsche from Beyond Good and Evil, and it reads, "Human maturity. This means rediscovering the seriousness we had towards play when we were children." Seriousness towards play. That almost sounds oxymoronic, if that's an adjective. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
It does.
I was going to say, what do you think about this, Cyrus?
I think it's absolutely true. I think it's true. And I think children are actually dead serious when they play. It's like the whole world is that moment. That whole, nothing else matters when you're playing with a little boy and he has a little lightsaber in his hand and you're chasing him around like a monster, and he thinks he needs to keep you away. And when he can, he starts crying, and he goes to his mom, and then you have to console him, be like, "No, it's okay. Look, it's me. It's your uncle. I'm not here to hurt you." Everything else falls by the wayside. It's this supreme ability to focus that we lose, that we don't hold on to.
I do think kids obsess about play. I know I really enjoyed the game Monopoly as a kid. And it wasn't enough to hoard all of the dollars and win once. I needed to constantly bail out my family so that I could beat them repetitiously. But what do you make of the human maturity at means rediscovering the seriousness we had towards play? So if we accept that kids have a seriousness towards play, that's one oxymoron. I think we've uncovered that it's not actually an oxymoron. It just is an apparent one. But how do we rediscover this seriousness we had towards play? And why is that a mature thing to do?
I witnessed that in conservatory school. We had a voice class with this one particular teacher, Jennifer. She was, I love her to death, but at the very beginning, she was quite a character. And it was difficult for a lot of the students to take her seriously at first. She was brilliant. But she would have us go around. She'd have us do various exercises that were play, essentially. And at first, none of the students could take it seriously. They would break character, they'd crack up. But the idea was to just don't try anything, don't do anything, just be sincerely. You'd walk around the space and you'd stop and you'd stare at someone else, eye to eye. And people would crack up and whatnot. But what she was trying to do was to get people comfortable again with just being silly, with not being normal, like having a social interaction that's very different. And people couldn't do it. Like, they just could not do it. You could say they didn't have the maturity to just sit there and be able to behave like this. And it took a while for them to get it. And they were rediscovering this ability to not feel self-conscious about what other people were thinking of them. And it really is word for word exactly like this quote, this rediscovering a maturity that is unafraid of, what's the word, criticism.
The midwit meme, we start off serious about play, then we become unserious about play, and then we need to rediscover the seriousness about play. I'm curious. What were you going to say?
I was going to ask you guys, why do you think we need to rediscover the seriousness about play? Why is it important?
Yeah. So I have a hypothesis about what Nietzsche's doing here, and then I want to hear Nico's take on if he agrees with.
Yeah, I think there's three lines that you can take from this quote, and two of them are let's say more. One is a very Nietzschean one. One is this idea of, have you guys heard of homo ludens?
Yep.
The term homo ludens, yeah. The playing man, yeah. Which is an idea that was coined by a I don't know if he's a philosopher. Huizinga, in the 20th century, I think late half, he wrote this. So there's a few thinkers that talked about the aspect of play, no? I was going to say the ludicity of man, but that's not an English term. But yeah, the Nietzsche.
The ludic. Ludic.
Yeah, the ludic, yeah, that's the ludic. Yeah, the ludic aspect, yeah. Ludicity. But
the flute, like the lute is related to it.
The lute, the ludic, yeah. That's interesting. There's a bunch to say about this, but let me start with the idea that I think what the quote is punning on is that we associate maturity to everything that's opposite to being playful about life, no? Being serious is not about playing around. It's about, I don't know what it is. That's the question. But my question would be, don't we play games all the time? Isn't everything structured around games, the games we play? No. At the end of the day, there is exchange. We get things, we lose things. How do we get them? There's rules. Everything works like a game.
Yeah, but the point is, let's accept that, right? What is your attitude towards the game? Are you disassociated from the game because it's merely a game? Or this is a game and you embrace its rules and its constraints and you take joy in playing the game and you have agency over the future of the game and you want to win, or you want to define what winning is. So I think that Nietzsche is associated with a movement called vitalism. And many people throughout history have pointed out, let's say, the illusory nature of reality. And one way, and this is an ascetic ideal, and one way that people discount reality is to say it's a game, as if that lets you off the hook from playing it. Don't play that game. Play some other game. Don't play the game of trying to get famous or make money or get the whatever your society values as the thing that you're supposed to get. Rather, what you really want is enlightenment, or you really want a place in heaven or whatever it is. And I think what Nietzsche is saying, again, my version of Nietzsche, my gamified Nietzsche, is the Nietzsche Zohar GPT, is that it doesn't really matter what game you're playing, but play it wholeheartedly. Don't use the fact that it's a game as a kind of lazy excuse for not giving it your all. You want to play the game of getting into heaven and getting 70 virgins? Play that game. You want to play the game of becoming as enlightened as the Buddha? Play that game. You want to become as successful as you think Tim Ferriss is? Play that game. But play it with seriousness, man. Now, I do think Nietzsche in another regard would say some games are better than others. Some games are more conducive to vitalism than others, and would probably disagree with my framing there, because my framing kind of equalized the various religious and metaphysical games with more materialistic ones. I think actually his critique of religion, of asceticism in particular, is that it does lead us to not play the game in front of us. He would take a stronger attitude, I think, and say that if you're trying to play the saintly game, you're doing that because you're unwilling to play the societal game, and that's a bad thing. So that would be maybe one on the one hand, but then the existentialist Nietzsche would say that the societal game is a false game as well, and so that kind of makes him religious in a weird way. If by religious we simply mean, because if we think of thus spoke of Zarathustra, the prophetic model of walking away from herd mentality to go construct your own sense of what requires worship, the trends of values. So Nietzsche's he's hard to summarize, because many people know him as the sort of the critic of religion, but you can also see him as a kind of pious, in a way, challenger of religion, because it's insufficiently radical and has become too bourgeois. And so if we use this game point, it's on the one hand knowing that it is a construct and it is a matter of play, but then still playing it with this complete energy. I guess that's a difficult line to walk. Some people play the game but don't realize it's a game. So they have the seriousness, but they don't have the sense of irony. And other people distance themselves from the game altogether, but then they don't play it.
Say the ideal is to be like the bodhisattva who's recognizes the cycle and can leave, but chooses to come back and participate.
Yeah, I find that extremely problematic. I always found that the bodhisattva stuff extremely problematic, but that's a different conversation.
it's current conversation.
Yeah.
It reminds me of
it makes some sense because so maybe this plays off of what I was thinking when Zohar was talking is that I think the same way, I just maybe have a more based approach to the problem, which is there is no option. You are playing a game. You just don't know which game you're playing. The whole quote, I think it can be read as a pun on that is like, what we call human maturity is idiotic at the end of the day. We think we are mature. We're like, we just don't know what we're doing. But to go and to try to connect this to the bodhisattva thing. A bodhisattva is defined by the fact that someone who can achieve enlightenment, and we have to precise what we mean by enlightenment here, because, and I'll get back to a second, chooses not to leave and stays, no, or let's say returns, to enlighten other beings. So basically the idea is that the path, the higher path of enlightenment, if you will, is the enlightenment of other people. Or let's say enlightenment is achieved through the enlightenment of another person. And this is my quibble with the thing, is in a stark opposition or contrast to another ideal, another ascetic ideal that used to be more popular than the bodhisattva, which is the arhat. Have you guys heard of that term before? An arhat? Yeah, arhat. This is, let's say, the bodhisattva stuff pops up around 3rd century after AD. Common era, second to third. It comes with what you call Mahayana Buddhism, which is the second, the large vehicle. No? I'm not going to get into that either. But before that, there is this ideal of the Arhat, which, to put this very simple and to bring it home, an Arhat, or let's say enlightenment, is and everything. And what I mean by enlightenment, I don't mean like individual enlightenment. Everything is solved in life by saving yourself, let's say, by enlightening yourself. No, it's not about other people, it's about you. And other people will follow through when you do it yourself. It's a kind of a mimetic model. No, it's the greater good is achieved by a model. No, people getting, in a sense, to put it, yeah, that's an arhat. You don't focus on other people, it's like you focus on yourself. And through your enlightenment, other people will see that and will try and pursue the path. The bodhisattva thing is the total opposite. Focus on other people. Because in focusing on other people, you will, in a sense, enlighten yourself. No, the problem with this is that, and I'm going to shut up in a minute, is no, that...
It's all you. Sorry.
trying to get a good clip. I'm gonna be Deadpooling.
I'm a gardener. I have hedge clippers.
So no, but I'm this is serious stuff. I'm not trying to like play for the camera. The whole problem is that in the original conception of enlightenment in Sanskrit, is the term is moksha. It's not nirvana, or like they contest each other, but it's more moksha. And moksha means isolation. So how can you achieve isolation by trying to save other people? That's the contradiction, inherent.
I had a slightly different understanding of what a bodhisattva was, but my introduction and the scope of my knowledge is just through Alan Watts books. That's it. I don't have nearly the depth of your.
What was your understanding?
My understanding was that a bodhisattva was someone who was a Buddha who achieved and recognized that the cycle and it's all just a game and it doesn't really, none of it matters and all that stuff. But then out of the compassion for other people, then decide to return and play the game for other people, not to achieve enlightenment. They've already achieved it, but they simply just go back because it's all a game, so they choose to play the game. It's like in the next meta level of understanding. Yeah. There's nothing else but the game. You could sit outside of it, but you know.
But the whole point of, let's say, of achieving, if it's achievable, if it's an achieving is really the question, but of becoming enlightenment is to step outside of the game. It's to leave the game altogether. Samsara is the cycle of rebirths, right? It's the cycle between pain and pleasure.
Yeah, it was.
They found
that or reached that, and then it's
disengaging, right? It's you disengage from the cycle. This is in order to. So I'll give you like a rundown of something that kind of explains the whole thing, which is Buddhism is a development, like developed around like 5th century BC. No? But there's a way of understanding that Buddhism doesn't start in a vacuum. It originates from, let's say, call it Upanishadic knowledge, no? The Upanishads, right? We all know what those are. We put them in the meditations, no? But the thing is, the Upanishads is the last part of the canon of the Veda. We talked a bit about this, I think it was a few episodes ago. Yeah. The interesting thing about that is that being the last part of the Veda, it represents about 10% of, let's say, call it the whole scripture. It's not scripture, but whatever, let's call it scripture. Mm. No? Mm-hmm. And the Upanishads are about one thing, which is moksha, enlightenment, no? Isolation, surpassing the cycles of samsara, pain and pleasure. But really what's interesting, and this I learned from my third Sanskrit guru, I call it guru, but you're just an academic professor, but you call them gurus anyway. So is that 90% of the Veda, it's not about enlightenment. It's about karma. Enlightenment has nothing to do with karma. And what does karma mean in Sanskrit? Action. It comes from the root kr, which means to do something or to create, in fact, also. The interesting thing is it being about karma, all of that 90%, the Samhita, the initial stuff is crazy, kind of mythology. There's a lot of mythology in it, but it's about ritual action. It's what you do in this world to achieve what you want. In this one, not in the next. Or there is also a lot of, let's say, that was a mistake, I correct myself. There is a next world, but that's not moksha. That's just another scale in the spheres of being, like the gods. Right. So if you want to reincarnate in a higher realm, like you can do some ritual actions in this world to achieve that. But that's not enlightenment. And enlightenment altogether is stepping outside of the whole, let's say, hierarchy of beings, no? And why am I saying all of this? Because in a nutshell, let's say action has nothing to do. There's two planes. There's the plane of doing. I think this in an Arendtian way, you would call it the via activa, no? The active way. And then the via contemplativa, or the passive, I think you could say. I'm like doing this is a hard cognitive jump. But the idea being that nirvana, enlightenment, all of these things, it's not about doing something. The rest is its action. So games, ritual, playing, all of that is karma. Mm-hmm. It's not stepping outside of the plane. And the bodhisattva thing, no, is problematic because of that. Because you say, and this is the underlying, if you will, theory to the whole thing, or call it theological exegesis of why they can say that someone who is in the path of enlightenment decides to come back or not to enlighten and has that decision, is because that they say that nirvana and samsara are the same thing. And this is a Mahayana development. It's, to put it, let's say, in a... Mm-hmm. How can you conceive of something that is outside? How is that possible from this world? This is in philosophy, pops up all over the place. In the Western canon or also. It's how can you conceive of something that is not from this world in this world? How is that possible?
I have a lot.
They're saying there is none.
Yeah.
I agree with the plausibility of everything you said, but it seems like there could be many other plausible ways to interpret these frames, including the Bodhisattva one. So let me give another approach, not a disagreeing one, just another way to think about it. Mm-hmm. In Star Wars, both Darth Vader yes. and Luke Skywalker are enlightened. They both have achieved moksha. How do we know this? Because they can skillfully wield the Force. However, one is a good guy and one is not. Notwithstanding the fact that at the end of his life, Darth Vader does come back to the good side, to the light side. But Darth Vader is enlightenment without compassion. Darth Vader is the instantiation of amoral approach to enlightenment, which focuses exclusively on attention and focus and perhaps a suspension of attachment without a grounding in ethics. And the Bodhisattva, whether he's real or not, in some sense represents this moral guardrail that as much as we want to change our perception and change our orientation, we don't want it to come at the cost of social life. Rather, we want it to be pro-social in some way. We want, if your enlightenment makes you less connected to your fellow man, in some sense it's enlightenment, but in another sense it's a failure. And then we can haggle over what kind of failure. Is it merely an ethical failure, or is it also in some sense an ontological one? And that's the history in Western philosophy between whether ethics comes before ontology, which is the Levinasian approach, or whether ontology comes before everything, which was Heidegger's approach. And I would suggest Heidegger is a kind of Darth Vader. And we should learn from him, both because he wielded the Force genuinely and because he is a kind of embodiment of a person who optimizes only for an understanding of being without a grounding in compassion. And I'm not a scholar of Buddhist practice, but I know that in many lineages, the meditation begins with a dedication to somebody or some group, or perhaps to, may the suffering of all sentient beings be reduced or diminished, or in other words, and you might say, why have a dedication at the beginning of the meditation? Why not just go into breathing? But I think it represents the moral hazard. It's a kind of Surgeon General's warning of what happens if you do this enlightenment path without a care for your fellow. So the question is, if the Bodhisattva is more enlightened than the person who chooses to leave, or if it's a kind of noble lie because we are afraid of the consequences of essentially promoting, I would say, a Nietzschean.
An outside?
A Nietzschean path whereby the best leave, the best feel superior, and leave everybody else in the dust. And so I think that would be one frame for thinking about the Bodhisattva, is the Bodhisattva represents the conjoining of the ontological and the ethical. And then the question is, if it's a sincere pairing, or if this is a story that we tell people or a moral that we try to reinforce, because in fact, the dirty secret is that Darth Vader's enlightened, but it's just, we don't want to talk about that because what are the moral implications if that's true? So that's one offering. A second offering is, I see a connection to the story of Job, which is...
We'll always go back to Job. It's so funny.
Whoever you are, like however well you keep doing, you can always be challenged more. And so your sense of success is always relative. You think you're blessed. You think you're enlightened. Don't publicize that, because if you do, Satan's going to get wind of it. And he's going to say, this person just hasn't been tried hard enough. Torture them, take away their family, put them through the works, and let's see how they meditate then. And the Bodhisattva is in a way a more humane way of saying this point, which is, you think you're enlightened? Bullshit. Go back and run it again on hard mode. Only this time, stop being so selfish and ignoring everybody else so that you can go on your meditation retreats. And now try caring for the sick and the dying. Try being a parent of kids that are shouting at you. Let's see how your enlightenment works out in that go around. And we'll keep upping the ante until if you can make it through the worst, then you're enlightened. But otherwise, it's a bypass.
What if Darth Vader says, I don't care what you think, because I'm enlightened anyway? What I'm thinking here is...
I see no moral reason why
I'm not trying to defend Darth Vader. I'm not trying to say that an arahat is like...
I've met Darth Vader. I can speak from first-person experience that there are such people who have tremendous powers of perception, tremendous insight, and are also deeply whacked in a way that I personally think I would not take that trade. And maybe they're metaphysically right. I don't know. But to me, it feels like there is some kind of deal with the devil or something. The other paradox is, when you're in the enlightened state, you're detached from your ego. You're boundless in a way. However, in those brief moments where you're not in a meditative state, what happens when you return to everyday life? And here I think that the non-meditative person has, in some sense, an ethical advantage over the person who, let's say, is meditating 23/7, which is the person who comes back for their 1 hour of normal life from their trip is usually an egomaniac, because they think, look, I'm so enlightened, I'm more enlightened than everybody else. And in one respect, they're not wrong. But in another respect, I think it just leads to this inflated sense of self. And so perhaps there's an asymmetry between Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, in that I think Luke Skywalker, if you will recognize the element of Darth Vader in himself, will recognize the danger of him becoming like Darth Vader if he's not careful. But there is no such caution or self-critique on the side of Darth Vader. In fact, that's how Darth Vader, in the sort of prequel to the story, becomes Darth Vader, is that he becomes so full of his own self-righteousness that nobody can walk him down.
I have a question, because sticking to the Star Wars saga here. No, but I think it's a good example. Of course, it has a bunch of religious overtones, and you know, it takes inspiration from...
It's a clippable example.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's what human nature is.
But we should keep the meta podcast stuff, like. There can only be one Deadpool in the show, I think. It shouldn't be you, Cyrus.
There's only one world, and there's only one podcast. There's no cutting room for it. Right? That's the whole dualism, is thinking that there's this world and then there's also the world in which we talk about it, but it's all the same world.
Really? Yeah. We're going to leave our Straussian tendencies somewhere else. But to go back to the Star Wars thing, is my question would be, can you be Luke? No? Can you know the power that you have and restrain yourself, or let's say edify yourself, no, in a certain direction, which is not the dark side, what do they call it, the light side, in Star Wars, without first tasting a little bit of the dark side? Because otherwise I think it's a delusion, you know. You need to have a bit of a taste of it to see what it can do.
I agree.
It's otherwise you're like preaching. It's like you're selling happiness on Instagram.
Think of it think of the character of Moses. He fits the archetype of the reluctant prophet who, when he stands at the burning bush and God tells him to go and liberate his people, he says, why me?
Yes.
And challenges God. Are you sure you got the right guy? Here are my deficiencies, such that I wouldn't be a good leader. And God's response is, well, then take Aaron, your brother, with you, and he can be your spokesperson. Don't worry about being verbally acute. That's not why I appointed you. But so that would be the archetype of the person on the light side having a certain hesitancy, in contrast to the person on the, right, you don't want to appoint the guy, I've been waiting for you to call on me, God. Finally, someone gets it. Yeah, you're right. A little late to the game. But before this episode, Moses, the reason he flees from Egypt is because he strikes an Egyptian taskmaster dead when he sees him abusing an Israelite slave. And you can certainly look at that vignette as an example of Moses having a correct moral compass, because he sees an injustice and he responds. But clearly it's an outburst of anger as well, and a motif throughout his life one that he doesn't completely lose. Later on in the Book of Numbers, he strikes a rock and performs a miracle, but we know from commentaries and context from a place of anger. Like, he's upset at the people for being stubborn. And so rather than speak to the rock, which is what God tells him to do, he hits the rock. And so you can see that even if he has the correct moral compass, that his anger is, well, it's a little dose of Darth Vader, I would say. But yes, Moses must have this self-awareness of his own dark side, if you will. Perhaps that's very much connected to his hesitancy, that because he knows, interpolating, if you give me power, how do I know I won't become like Pharaoh? Why do I think that I'm going to be better? And of course, you want that person in this position of power as opposed to the person who simply thinks that they deserve the power. In most ancient societies, the ruler is considered to be a god, and nobody could challenge him. Whereas in the Israelite tradition, all the leaders know that they're not God, and not only do they not are they not worshipped, but the job of the prophet is to tell those leaders when they're wrong. This is more of a dynamic later on in the Bible with kings. But we know that King David is a great king, in part because when Nathan tells him that he sinned, instead of killing him, which is what most kings would have done, he says, "You're right," and immediately atones. So we don't hold up David as a model of a king who didn't abuse his power, because that would be unreasonable. All kings are going to have some Darth Vader energy. It's how else can you defeat all your competitors? It's not for the faint-hearted. But he still has the heart of a psalmist, and so that counterbalances it, and that's the compromise we want.
And Nico, Luke does get a bit of the dark side at the end.
Yeah.
And he strikes Darth Vader at him in anger and is about to end his life, and then realizes what he's almost done and casts aside his weapon.
Yeah, and then you can go extreme. You can go like psychoanalytical on the whole movie. It's like the whole movie is about someone killing their father.
It's also right? very
without
much
knowing
relates,
it. Very Oedipus.
Much relates, it very much relates to Nietzsche as well, though, because in Christianity, the enlightened posture is to turn the other cheek, culminating in the deification of a man who allows himself to be crucified. The flex, Jesus's flex, if I can be irreverent in my postulation, is that he says, I don't need to fight for my life. I give it up freely. I don't need to fight for my happiness. I allow myself to be tormented. That's in a sense, the ultimate flex. So Luke, by not striking down Darth Vader in anger, follows this Christian ethic of the humble shepherd rather than, let's say, the powerful warlord. In a way, the story is almost like the Christian version of good versus the Genghis Khan version of good. And the Genghis Khan version of good, it's just two guys with red lightsabers, and the guy with the bigger lightsaber wins, and it's, wow, great swordsmanship. And I think Nietzsche, one of his critiques, we've talked about this in previous episodes of Christianity and Judaism and sort of Western morality, is the celebration of the humble servant, the suffering servant, as opposed to the Genghis Khan. And in a Nietzschean story, we've got it backwards, and actually the red lightsaber is the good side, because it's the unvarnished side. It's the true expression of human nature. And what we call the light side is just a feat, virtue, and effeminization of man and all of this kind of stuff.
Let me say something about that, because I think it ties to the quote, because of course, you can read Nietzsche like that, but I think Nietzsche's, let's say, call it fixation with the warrior mentality or the warrior ethic, no? Which is the strongest, the fittest, the master, like the most powerful, is not so much because, let's say, a masculinization of, or a fetishization of the Greeks. Or the ancients. You can totally read Nietzsche like that, because it's pretty clearly from his statements that he has this thing, a knack for dudes with sticks and swords. But I think when you bring this, the considerations that Nietzsche has towards, let's say here, no? Children playing, no? Or in the Zarathustra, that's one of the lines you can read this quote, is that in the Zarathustra, there's this the metamorphoses of the Zarathustra, the camel, the lion, and the child. So like in the Zarathustra, there's this moment where, I don't remember where because it's been ages since I last read it, but that Nietzsche makes this symbolic distinction between what a camel is, what a lion is, and what a child is. And to put it shortly, like the camel carries weight, the lion fights against something, and the child doesn't do. So it's, the camel is basically a servant. It's like carrying others' weight.
Obedience.
It's exactly, obedience. It's submissive. The lion rebels against that. It rebels against an alterity, another. But it's still tied. It's still
dependent on that thing.
It's still in the struggle. It's still in the struggle of another with another. The child is an overcoming of the whole thing because the child is pure innocence. I wouldn't say he doesn't care. He cares about his play, no, in a sense. And how do you tie this in, like this praise of innocence and of play and of, without, of course, like doing a bunch of psychoanalytical readings on Nietzsche, which you can do there, and that's totally fine, but that's not what I'm doing here, is that the reason why there's this fascination. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say, you must be talking about one-year-olds, because I think once children hit around two, they're already lions. they want what they can. They have this reflexivity. So I think I agree with the archetype, with the archetypal distinction, but I also feel that it's a bit untrue to the phenomenology of childhood. Like children are...
You can speak about this. Zohar is the only father and the only parent of the whole crew, in fact, not just of the day. But yeah, like just what I want to say is that I think that the fascination with the warrior in Nietzsche is tied to the fact that the warrior defines what is in a way and what is in another way. So he says, this is good and this is bad. It's called transvalorization. Like you create your own values.
Yeah.
That's play. The hyper play is to create your own game. Going insane.
I'm not gonna ask you what would Nietzsche say in response to this critique, but more like how would you defend Nietzsche if in fact you would against this point? Warriors are competitive. They don't actually have values that come from themselves. They are very much herd-like in their conception of what a glorious life is. To win a battle and act valiantly, and we see this, if you want to fast forward 2000 plus years to jock culture, when, you know, think of a football team or a soccer team. When I think of people that are setting their own sense of value, I don't really think of the person whose goal is to score the most baskets. I feel like it's quite generic in a way.
Totally, yeah.
So how does, I get the innocence point, but I don't actually see the creativity in the transvaluation of values. I actually think that their values are quite generic. They seem
to be. You mean the warrior?
The warrior seems just as herb-like in his conception of what's good as the 19th century Christian shopkeeper who goes to church because that's what one does.
Right.
As opposed to out of a sense of piety.
Yeah. I'm going to say, so first of all, like in the gay science, there's a quote, another aphorism that goes something like, when the warrior leaves the battle, he goes to war against himself. No? And you can see this kind of like in job culture and stuff. They don't have anything to do. They do stupid stuff. But so that's it's one more, point. But like, in that regard,
with Dennis.
I think we did like a few months ago. But so I guess in that regard, the warrior is a lion. Yeah. He's tied to the spirit of battle. With no battle, what happens when you're a dragon slayer and there's no more dragons? Don Quixote.
You find the dragon in everything else.
Yeah.
He who is good with a hammer tends to see everything as a nail.
Yeah, exactly.
Creates his own
bomb. No, my defense of Nietzsche here would be to say what we're talking here is about an artist, not about a warrior. No? That's the creativity
but
comes
I
from
think,
there. Not
but
from,
I think
from
that
a fighter.
So that brings us full circle though to how I open on Nietzsche, which is I think there is an ambiguity here. If really the highest calling is to be an artist, then surely as an artist, you can choose whether to exercise your craft within the frame of a warrior culture or within some other culture, including a religious one, including a secular one, but certainly there shouldn't be a constraint on the artist, and we shouldn't claim to know from the onset what the art is going to look like. By definition, it's going to be contrarian. For Nietzsche, it was contrarian.
Well, if you ask, yes.
To be this sort of bad boy, but perhaps in a society where being a bad boy, if you will, is the norm, he would have found a contrarian artistic way to defend being a nice guy. And it's more about being an individual than it is really about the nobility of warrior culture.
It's funny because, I don't know, I'm like throwing the ball outside of the park here, or like kicking the ball to another court. But I think that when it comes to bad guys, let's say in German philosophy, I think Heidegger was much more of a bad boy than Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche is portrayed as this, but I think Heidegger is like the...
I think Heidegger was a bad guy in his private life.
In a very banal
sense. Like, I think he was unremarkably bad, if you will. I don't think he was artisanally bad. I think he was a cliche.
Yeah.
Like a soap opera.
So you think Nietzsche is more of a provocateur than Heidegger in that regard? Philosophically,
Nietzsche specifically addresses culture as a culture critic. And Heidegger is much more veiled and abstracted in his critique of culture. Like, he does have provocations to offer, but they're largely off the cuff. And then when he's systematic, he's mostly criticizing other philosophers, because Heidegger's contrarianism is almost to say that nobody matters other than philosophers, and that, like, the history...
But that's what every philosopher... That's like the history of philosophy. The way you start a book is by saying how everybody before you was wrong. You know? We found this...
He writes famously that, like, the dropping of the atom bomb, or the invention of the atom bomb, was a fatalistic necessity once Plato came up with the forms. And that it was so my point is, with that level of abstraction, where you're criticizing Plato for the dropping of the atom bomb in Hiroshima, it's not even provocative, because most people are like, what are you even talking about? You need a reality check. It's almost the ravings of a lunatic. I feel that Nietzsche was much more microscopic in his understanding of everyday life. And although he was certainly trained in close reading, he's not really as interested in what does Plato have to say as he is in how are people living in the 19th century and why they're living the wrong way. And he's willing to tell you what he thinks. Heidegger just creates the sense of mystique. But I feel that, again, I can go both sides on it, but if I'm being cynical, put it this way, if I'm being cynical and I was trying to train a GPT in the art of manipulation, I would probably have it do many of the things Heidegger does, which is create a very vague sense of what's wrong with culture that inadvertently or subtly leads the listener to think that I've got the answer without ever revealing what the answer is, so that you keep coming back for more. I feel that Nietzsche is more forthcoming in both his actual criticisms as well as in his solutions. Even if we disagree with those solutions or they're contradictory, he tells you, here's what the medicine is. Heidegger just ends up saying, only a God can save us, or we haven't yet asked the question of being. And okay, I'll read your 300-page book in the hopes that you'll tell me how. And at the end of it all, it's just, being is temporality. Thanks, bud.
Yeah.
So he's
well,
really
but
good.
But that's huge. I think that's a huge thing, though. I think that's a huge thing that most people do not understand. Not most people, but like philosophically, nobody thought about it that way, right? That being is tied to time. Like, I mean, I don't want to get technical, but we were Kantians before Heidegger came into the picture, for the most part.
I like Heidegger as a philosopher. I just think that rhetorically, he's a bit of a dandy. Makes a great first impression.
And the hut.
But not the guy you want to wake up with a year later when he's still giving you the sort of clickbait or persona version. Like, who's the real Heidegger?
Yeah.
The real Heidegger is a disappointment. So that's me being cynical. I can also say I think he's a Darth Vader who definitely touched something deep, but totally without any sense of care for people, and probably because he was high on his own supply.
I was gonna say, imagine a sleepover at Heidegger's Hut in the dark, in the Black Forest.
I'd rather not. I mean, if we think about any of these philosophers, like in greater detail, I think they really shrink down from the magnitude that they create through the aura of their work. And there's sort of different things you can do with that. You can say that's just the way it is. People have a persona, and as soon as you puncture it, you realize that people are just people.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
well, the work is the work, right? Yeah.
The work is the work. You can also view it as aspirational. Like, their works represent their ambition to become more like the people in their works that they're writing, and they've invented a kind of character for themselves. And just because the actor is got a dysfunctional life when he goes home after the play, while he's doing the play with the seriousness that he had as a child, we really enjoy the play and we benefit from it.
I have the perfect solution for this problem. I didn't invent it, but you get rid of the author. That's what the French did. Oh, the death of the author. It doesn't matter.
I think that works for ancients because it's hard.
It does as well.
It's certainly hard to visualize Plato. And even if you were a historian and could construct his life based upon very fragmented sources, he's already in such a different world that he's significantly unrelatable that in a way it makes him more relatable. But when you get to the closer to our own time, certainly with the modern figures, it's very hard to create this sense of they're on a stage and we're in the audience. And so I don't feel that the death of the author is as easy of a maneuver to do, even if that was the strategy.
Didn't talk about play.
No, some people feel the same way about art or movies when something comes out about an artist or director that's recrimonious, and suddenly their works are devalued.
Who's the guy in House of Cards?
To some people, and then to some people they say Kevin Spacey. Yes.
Kevin Spacey. I love Kevin Spacey. He was one of my favorite actors, and he played a villain, and then you're like, oh, and he actually is a villain. If you agree, if you accept the allegations, should I have enjoyed his performance of Orme if it was coming from a sincere place as opposed to an imaginative loop or something like this? It feels like you're almost like complicit. But that's where I think, again, it's like he's alive.
No.
And he's out there. And so you feel a sense of, it goes back to this two worlds versus one world thing, this meta point. You feel that we're all in one world. And if we're all in one world, then you don't get to be an actor during these hours and a human being during those hours because it's the same world.
Yeah.
But somehow the dual world hypothesis that you can enter this ideal realm and almost abstract yourself into the work, that seems easier to accomplish the more otherworldly you are to begin with. Again, this is an interesting phenomenological topic. I don't know
what to say about it. Well, this could open up a can of worms, but the idea of, because what you were high on when you were saying this was like the idea of Pierre Hadot, philosophy as a way of life. So like you have to look at the writer, what he's doing there to see if he's actually, and I like Hadot and I'm not trying to criticize you, but I cannot resist to think of this, no? Or this thought, which is, a person, no? And you interact with a person and whatever, you know who they are, blah, blah, blah. But you don't really know them because you don't know how they are in the bedroom or in their house or what are their like kinks or like their fetishes. And this is the kind of, you go into like the psychoanalytic thing, which is
like... You could have just said, how are they like at the dinner table, you know?
No, because that's not the point. The point is that, like, we subscribe to the idea that there's essential things about a person, which for them to be essential, they have to be secret. or they have to be obscure. Obscurity works in that way, I think, and that's why I'm fascinated by obscurity. I think religion has mastered that for sure, the management of the mysteries, and it's something that
a person can have whatever dysfunctional or functional or admirable or villainous personal life and be a mathematician whose work advances the field. But once we delve into the realm of the aesthetic and the moral and the ontological, I think most of us assume, I'm not going to say all, but I think most of us assume that there is some correlation between the person's life and their contribution. And if we find out something about their life gives us pause, then it's difficult to make the separation vis-a-vis the work. And there's different ways that people can think about the relationship between the two and how much you can save the baby from the bathwater and this kind of thing. I'm certainly not in the camp of people who say, let's not read Heidegger, or let's not learn even positive things, forget even cautionary tales from people who have made moral errors. Let's also not get on our high horse and assume that we're better than those people, or that we wouldn't have done something comparable in their shoes. But I still think that it's fair to look for, if you will, a blind spot in the thought as a result of a certain deficiency in the life. And that's not because we should look for people's blind spots. I think it's just an act of humility. It goes back to the Luke Skywalker point, which is, if a great person has a failing in some way, then we probably do as well. We who are less great. And also maybe we shouldn't optimize for greatness in the way that we're defining greatness. Perhaps we should be more discerning in our own. Actually, this is a Nietzschean point. We shouldn't let our heroes dictate the path for us. We should gather information, which includes both what the heroes accomplished as well as what they failed in, and then ask ourselves, is that the path I want for myself? Or do I want a path in which I'm more balanced in some way? And can I create a path for myself in which I'm more open to self-critique or self-correction, given that when I look at these case studies, I see that they made these errors. And that's just at the micro level of, let's say, an individual, like a Heidegger is, let's say, an outlier. But then you can take a more macro or like trends approach and say, it's interesting that what percentage of philosophers, I'm just riffing here, but I've seen some version of this on Twitter, what percentage of philosophers were present fathers? Now, of course, for most of human history, like, the role of a father was very different than what it might be now in 20th century America. But like, Rousseau abandoned his children. I think, you know, that's interesting. I think that's pretty messed up. And also the fact that he wrote about childhood development and education, and the fact that he abandoned his kids, like, those need to be taken together. So similarly, I don't know much about how Kant was with kids, but this to me is an interesting lacuna when you take philosophers as a class, that there's very little about their relationships, not just with kids, but as well with their wives, their partners. And when the data that we do have, it's not like we think these were particularly admirable folks in their personal lives. So it makes you wonder, do I want to be a philosopher? Do I really want to be like Hegel? Ultimately, even if everything he says is brilliant. And if I want to be a more balanced person, how can I take maybe a 60th of Hegel into my life without swallowing the whole Kool-Aid? That's just me.
That's why
I'm doing lightning and not academia on some level. It's not just, let's say, the broken incentives that I happen to see in academia as a structure. It's also like, when you actually interrogate the archetype of the lives of professors, and this isn't meant as an ad hominem, because sei gesund, each should pursue their own sense of a good life. But I don't see models for the kind of life that I want to live in the lives of my teachers, even though I admit I've only seen them for from afar and with a squint. I can't claim to know, to your point, Nico, how they are in their, in their bedrooms.
I was going to say, I think Nietzsche would say the same. Nietzsche would say the same. But I dare you to do this. That would make a fascinating book. Like, there, have you heard of, and I think I'm well over time, so I'm not going to talk much, but Simon Critchley, British philosopher, teaches at the New School, wrote a book called The Book of the Dead Philosophers, which is, it's an encyclopedia about how everybody died. Everybody's talking about death. Hey, let's look at how they died. From like the pre-Socratics till, I think, Davida or something. I think you should do one about how they were as either lovers or fathers. And if, I mean, that would be fascinating.
We wouldn't be able to gather enough information on the lives of the past thinkers. We could certainly yeah. try for contemporaries, but the data would be probably pretty selective unless you did a Pew report.
Having the gaps is also
children, and then you have to compare that to the children of science professors as compared to then people who are then wealthy. Like, you need not only a large sample size but also different classes to understand what is beta and what is alpha and how much is caused by the substance of the thought versus just the sociology of your professor, and that sort of trains you to think in a certain way, irrespective of whether you publish on analytic philosophy or on the trolley problem or on Agamben.
Well, guys, we're coming to the end now. Give me a word or a phrase that you think you leave with this quote. Like a commandment, human maturity. Yeah. This means rediscovering the seriousness we had towards play when we were children. For me, it means what I take away from is be sincere. That's what I interpret seriousness as, sincerity.
Okay. I was going to say, you cannot take the jersey off.
So the commandment is don't take the jersey off.
Yeah. You can't. No, you can't take the jersey off, so you have to play.
Thou shalt not take the jersey off.
Yeah. Run.
I would say enjoy.
Fantastic. Guys, that concludes today's episode of the Lightning Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussion, remember, you can have your own on Chronicles on our WhatsApp group. You will find these discussions every day. If you found yourself listening to us saying, yes, I agree, and you had another point to further bring up, but you couldn't because you're listening to a recording and we've already moved on, you can join a live conversation with people and you can continue the thread however much you want on there. Links in the bio, guys. Have a good one.